WFM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to you, Jenny Green, for entertaining us this afternoon. It's Tuesday, the 28th of September, and this is Game On. Coming up today, Mark Langdon on Messi versus Pep as Man City travel to Paris.
Football, you never know. Life itself, you never know what's going to happen in a short time. And I'm pretty sure he will be happy there in Paris. PSG always, since Qatar, people took over the club, always is an exceptional team, winning a lot of titles and is a huge competitors.
In boxing, Darren O'Neill joins us ahead of his big final at the National Elites, and he'll give us his take on AJ's defeat.
All three scores go to the winner by unanimous decision. And new heavyweight champion
Alexander Usyk has produced a quite brilliant boxing display. That has bamboozled, befuddled and abused Anthony Joshua.
Plus Cork's new football manager Shane Ronan on his plans for the Rebels and Lisa Fallon on reducing headers in soccer training.
Game on 2FM.
Now, if you want to get in touch, please do so. You can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. So for all of you FIFA fans, we're very excited by the news that FIFA 2022 launches worldwide this Friday, October 1st. The new game offers deep and innovative features across gameplay, including their most popular modes, including career mode, Volta Football, pro clubs and the FIFA Ultimate Team. To celebrate its release, we have a copy of FIFA 22 for PlayStation 5 to give away every day this week to our listeners on Game On. All you have to do to be in with a chance to win is answer the following question. Which team are the current holders of the Champions League? Hint, they play Juventus tonight. So text us your answer and name to 51552 and the winner will be announced at the end of the show. So there are a lot of very interesting Champions League ties. Some of them are underway already. Ajax are playing Besiktas and Ajax are leading 1-0 there with 18 minutes gone. And Shakhtar Donetsk and Inter Milan are on are 18 minutes played. So we are going to get straight into the football because it is a very, very busy night of Champions League. Mark Langdon is with us on the line. Mark, there is only one place to start and that is with the meeting of Messi and Pep, or as other people are probably calling it, PSG and Man City. It is exciting.
Oh, it is. Absolutely, Marie. And the Spanish newspaper Marca today sort of were leading on the fact that this is, you know, to all intents and purposes, the most expensively assembled football match sort of ever. You know, the two teams that have cost, one just over $1 billion in Manchester City, one just under $1 billion in Paris Saint-Germain, facing off against each other. It is only the group stage and there's maybe not that jeopardy because we still expect both teams to qualify, but I think for this stage of the season, this is really about as big as the Champions League can get. And you know, there's so many sort of side issues as well as the fact of just who's going to win the game. One, of course, being that Messi against Pep Guardiola. And the one thing I would say though is if City play like they did against Chelsea on Saturday, they will be difficult to beat. I thought they were absolutely brilliant in that game.
Yeah, they really were. But look, when you do look at the two teams, Man City are definitely the form team. They probably have the better players across the board. They definitely have their system sorted out. They know exactly what they're doing. Everybody knows exactly what they're doing. But at the same time, PSG does have three unbelievable stars. But what can be done to try and get them to play as a team?
That's a question for Maurizio Pochettino, and one he hasn't worked out himself yet. I think what they need is they're going to need a lot of sort of humble players around those big three. And I think that's why we've seen the likes of Idrissa Gueye and Ander Herrera kind of be important players already for Paris this season, because you're going to need players to do the donkey work for those three, because they're not going, if they haven't got the ball, those three players are not going to do much in terms of helping the team out defensively. So Pochettino needs to find the right mix of kind of stars and those players that won't mind, you know, running around and maybe doing the work of one and a half people to make up for the fact that Messi's not going to track back, and nor is Neymar, and Mbappe doesn't do much of it either. He hasn't yet, it has to be said, managed to find that recipe, that winning formula. They were really poor in the Champions League on match day one, when they were fortunate really to draw 1-1 against Club Brugge. They did manage to beat Montpellier 2-0 at the weekend, but the game was kind of marred from Pochettino's point of view when after the match he was having to deal with press reports of Kylian Mbappe referring to Neymar as a tramp. He was seen lip reading words to that effect, and bemoaning the fact that his one-time friend, they used to be really close, wasn't passing the ball to him. So these are the kind of things that Pochettino has to put up with, as well as finding a winning formula, because you remember a couple of weeks ago we were speaking, when Messi was taken off, he was substituted, he walked off in a half. Now we've got Mbappe not happy with Neymar. They've only been together a few weeks, this front three. So far, it's proven nothing but problems really for Pochettino.
So we know that Messi has been injured. It does seem like he is okay anyway. Just when you think of the way they are going to set up, what does Pochettino do with them? Like, how can you set up with a team like that and give them enough space to do what they want to do and try and play with to their strengths?
Well, so he has been trying to play with the three-man forward line when they've all been fit, of Neymar on the left, Messi on the right, and Mbappe through the middle. You probably got all of the players in their preferred positions within that formation. Of course, Pep Guardiola was the man that moved Messi from the right into the centre to such great success. But I think that Messi does enjoy coming in from that right flank. Hakimi down the right-hand side, because Messi likes to tuck in from the right and come onto his favoured left foot. Hakimi, the right back, is somebody that when he was playing for Inter particularly, was a wing back. And so he offers that width down the right-hand side and has the energy to go up the flank and then get back. So, there maybe aren't enough players in the Paris Saint-Germain team that run as hard when they haven't got possession as when they have got it. So he's a very important player for them. What they have been doing is playing somebody like Diallo, who is really a centre back. They've been playing him as a left back to just stand there really and to not go forward, and when they haven't got possession, he can just be in the left back position. When they have got the ball, he moves across a little bit and they can play as a back three, which is quite a modern approach. I mean, it was something Italy did at the Euros, albeit sort of with the left back the one attacking. So that's what he tries to do. At least a couple of holding midfielders have been playing. I mentioned Idrissa Gueye and Ander Herrera as being two that have been important. Whether they both play tonight, I'm not so sure, because Di Maria he's somebody that has forced his way into the team and has become a very important player. Verratti as well is back from injury. Whether he's fit enough to start, I don't know. Wijnaldum, the player that came from Liverpool, hasn't started that well. Certainly hasn't brought the Dutch Wijnaldum that we saw at the Euros into Paris so far. Pochettino is going to have absolute nightmare with selection once everybody is fit. Ramos hasn't been sort of fully fit so far. And even in goal, of course, he's got to make a decision over Keylor Navas and Donnarumma. He has been choosing Keylor Navas, which hasn't gone down well with Donnarumma, who was voted the player of the tournament at the Euros. And already more suggestions in the French press that maybe the Spanish-speaking players, the influential ones, are the ones that are standing up for Keylor Navas and sort of demanding he be in the team. This is the kind of thing that Pochettino has to put up with on a kind of weekly basis, you know, these questions of player power within the dressing room.
How do you think he's coping?
I think he's doing okay. The problem's going to come when on a night like tonight, if they lose, because, you know, everything revolves around the Champions League for Paris Saint-Germain. I don't think that's a healthy situation for any club to be in, because we've seen down the years, you know, the Champions League, you can't order to win one. Juventus thought that when they bought Cristiano Ronaldo, that would be the difference for them. And if anything, it set them back. You know, Manchester City have been trying for a long time. Pep Guardiola hasn't won it since he left Barcelona. So, you know, there's many good teams in the Champions League. I think he's coping okay now. Whether he's able to deal with the flak if they go out of the Champions League early, I'm not so sure. I mean, it was an uncomfortable truce, really, this summer between him and the sporting director, Leonardo. Everything seems okay for now, but you're only ever, you know, one game away from your season almost being over at Paris Saint-Germain. That's how important and influential the Champions League is for them.
There's a big debate in my house now tonight. What do we watch? Do we watch PSG and Man City or Porto and Liverpool? What about you, Mark?
Oh, I'll be watching Paris against Manchester City. Of course, you know, if you support Liverpool, then I think you have to go for that game against Porto. And Porto played really well on match day one against Atletico Madrid. They were the better team in that 0-0 draw. So it's not going to be an absolute sort of stroll in the park, I wouldn't have thought, for Liverpool. So it'll be a competitive game, that one for sure. But Messi, Neymar, Mbappe, what Man City have got, I can't. There's no game that's going to drag me away from that one.
So just on that Liverpool-Porto game, just given the fact that they did concede those goals at the weekend against Brentford, how do Liverpool approach this? Just the fact that maybe they aren't as invincible as they thought before that game.
Yeah, I suppose it will have knocked the confidence slightly because they'd gone into that game sort of, you know, really feeling like they were defending well. They'd controlled a lot of teams that they played against. It maybe wasn't the most difficult of starts for them in the Premier League. And I suppose they did concede twice also, you know, against Milan on match day one. So there have been moments this season, I know Van Dijk didn't play in that game, but there have been moments maybe where they've not been in complete control of the game. And I think that is a concern. And I also think that Porto, as I mentioned, are probably better than many people kind of understand them to be. You know, this was a team that really did create enough chances to win a game against a tough Atletico Madrid team a couple of weeks ago on match day one. I just think that for all of those discussions, though, about Liverpool's defence and, you know, how will they cope with against Taremi and players like that, when you flip that in the reverse and say, well, how do Porto cope against Salah and everything that Liverpool have got? I think that is an even bigger question mark there. And you know, the best way of defending for Liverpool is to probably play like they do most weeks. And that's on the front foot, and let whatever the front three Jurgen Klopp decides to pick, because they've got this game against City coming up on Sunday, and he has rotated occasionally in the Champions League previously, but whatever team he picks, you know, should be good enough to get the goals required, I would have thought, to win the game, you know, even if it is only narrowly.
We also have another big one as well, AC Milan and Atletico Madrid, which is kicking off at 8 o'clock as well. Just given the fact that we have this lovely story, Daniel Maldini becoming the third generation of the Maldini family to score for AC Milan, are they, do you think, going to be back to their best?
I think they're best in terms of sort of... They're best of sort of, you know, 10 years ago, probably... They're not getting back to that level. In terms of what they can achieve now, I think that they are, you know, doing really well this season. And even against Liverpool on match day one, you know, they were quite happy. They lost 3-2, and they kind of, you know, gathered themselves as these underdogs and played as underdogs. And when they lost 3-2, it wasn't like they were disappointed, which maybe tells you where they're at sort of in their current rebuild. But you're absolutely right, at the weekend against Spezia, an amazing story, really, for Daniel Maldini, attacking midfielder, scored a header in front of his dad, Paolo Maldini, who's sort of, you know, one of the people behind the scenes at AC Milan now, of course. His granddad, Cesare Maldini, who died in 2016, also represented the club as a player and as a manager. So it really was a touching moment. And Maldini's played a big part in what AC Milan are trying to do now. He said that the club have had enough of, overpaying for players and wasting money, and that they've done that for year after year trying to get back to the top. They want young, hungry players. They've got the kind of older ones, Giroud and Ibrahimovic, but, those are just there, as kind of the foundations of the team. The rest of it, it's all about young and hungry players. I'm interested to see how they get on against Atletico, notoriously, a good at the dark arts, and have probably got the tick in the box of just being a bit more streetwise player for player. But they wasn't very good at all at the weekend against Alaves. So an opportunity maybe for Milan to get themselves right back in the group.
There's a couple of news stories as well floating around, and one that piqued a lot of people's interest yesterday was when the former FAI general manager Noel Mooney saying that it could be the time now for the UK and Ireland to launch a joint bid to host the 2030 World Cup. Do you think that there is any substance really to that when you think of everything that has happened over the last little while?
Well, I mean, there's been talk in the UK as well about, pushing for 2030. I would say that there are probably countries or sort of bids in sort of better shape for getting 2030 at the moment than a sort of UK and Irish bid. The sort of suggestions are that South America would be sort of the favourites, but COVID has impacted a lot, I think, in terms of what countries can afford, and it's a really expensive mission to even bid for a World Cup, never mind actually host it. But I think they would be sort of fighting against, like I say, this kind of notion really that it'll be going to South America. That seemed to be where the sort of the direction of thought at one time. But of course, I think there is more money around in terms of a bid from anywhere in Europe probably than what there is from South America. And as we've known previously, that money can talk as far as it goes with FIFA and UEFA.
And also the European Championship winners, Italy, are going to face Copa America winners Argentina in June 2022, which is pretty exciting as well.
I think this is a brilliant idea to kind of have like a sort of World Club Cup. Doesn't quite work, I don't think, because of the difference in quality between the European Champions League winner and the Copa Libertadores winner. Completely different story in terms of this. I think Italy v Argentina in a continental battle, absolutely brilliant. They're hoping to play the game in Naples, of course, the Diego Maradona Stadium, which would be a very fitting venue, you would have thought, for Italy against Argentina. So there's a lot of bad ideas in football. Thankfully, I don't think this is one of them.
And just before we finish up, N'Golo Kanté has coronavirus.
Yeah. I mean, he's... I don't think he played very well at the weekend. I don't know, obviously, if he was sort of starting to come down with anything then. It's been a really stop-start campaign for N'Golo Kanté. He hasn't really sort of featured enough for Chelsea this term. Hopefully he'll make a full recovery, and Chelsea have got such a big squad that it shouldn't matter too much to them, in the short term. But hopefully he'll be back in sort of 10 days or so.
Okay, Mark Langton, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We'll check in with you next week.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Get back on track after summer with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. I'm delighted now to be joined on the line by New Cork senior ladies football manager Shane Ronayne. Shane, how are things? Congratulations on the new job. I know it's one that you really wanted.
Yeah, how are you, Marie? I suppose it's a dream job for me, really. I'm over the moon. It's been a very hectic last 24 hours. The news that kind of broke over the weekend that I was being nominated for. So, I suppose I didn't want to count my chickens before they were hatched on the last night, and it's been a hectic less than 24 hours. The phone is going nonstop. So, look, it's great. I'm delighted to be doing it. I'm very honoured to be in the position that I'm in, and just really looking forward to the hard work that's going to be ahead.
Yeah, for sure. And look, just your career itself, it has been brilliant. You've been immersed in the women's game for quite some time now, and I'm sure you've seen it evolve. I think especially when you look at how this season played out with Meath being champions, being crowned champions. But it really is a sport, Shane, that's changing so much, and even the women playing it as well are changing so much.
Yeah, look, I've been involved, I started off in the county with Cork in 2014-15. I was there for 2 years, and even from then to now, it's been unbelievable, the change, I suppose, in the coverage, the profile it has, but the players themselves, I think, their conditioning and their professionalism is fantastic, and I suppose the same is happening at management level. The management teams are, just as big as some of the men's inter-county management teams, and the county boards are, evolving as well. And I think it's fantastic, the exposure it gets. And those players are finally getting the exposure they deserve, because they do put in as much, work as the boys do. So, it's fantastic. And it's great to be involved in it at this stage. And even, the coverage and the media interest in this job today, compared to what it would have been a few years ago, there's no comparison. And look, that's fantastic for the game. And, hopefully we can... if we can drive it on even more and, increase the audience, further.
Yeah, the thing as well, Shane, when you go into a job like that and you're now managing a team that traditionally has been so strong and the fans are used to them up there winning All-Ireland titles, there will be a lot of pressure on you to deliver.
Yeah, look, I suppose, but that's the way it goes, Marie. I suppose going into it that this was going to be the All-Ireland title is the currency for Cork ladies football. They haven't had one month since 2016, and that's a drought. I know it's only what, 5 or 6 years, but that's what it looks like, that's what it feels like down there, because they have been so successful under Eamon Ryan and on Efi's first year as well. So the pressure is there, but I think I'm just going to embrace that and go for it. And the players are certainly there in Cork, and we'd hope to be back at the top table very quickly, and that's the plan.
I read an interview you did a little bit earlier on with Damien Lawler, and you went through a little bit about how you had wanted the job and went for it a few years back, but it didn't work out. But you did go away from that, learn everything that you could, just to make yourself a better candidate, just to develop as a coach, as a manager, to put yourself in a position where you could go and do this job now.
Yeah, look, I think in lots of stages of my life, I've gone for things and maybe haven't got them, or I've got jobs when I didn't think I'd get them. I think all these things, they happen for a reason. I'm a firm believer in that. And I think 6 years later, I've certainly grown as a person, as a manager, and as a coach. And I think my experiences that I've gained over the last 6 years, both good experience and bad experience, when you're winning and losing big games, and I think that's going to stand to me now. I think I'm probably in a better position as a manager and as a person be taking over this role now, because it is a huge role. And look, maybe it would have been too big for me 6 years ago, and I gained a lot in the last 6 years, and things that I won in the last 6 years and successes I had in the last 6 years, I wouldn't have had those maybe if I was with Cork. So I think all these things are they're life lessons, and I feel myself that I'm just in a much better place to be taking on the role now, and you're really, really going to go for it.
Shane, says a lot as well about just the development of the women's game when you are moving from a men's job to a women's job, because often it's the case that it's the other way around.
Yeah, look, I said it to Damien already today, I suppose one of the only jobs that I would have left the Waterford set up for was Cork ladies, because I had a very good relationship with the players and the rest of my management, the county board down there. They were fantastic. Like Waterford are, down there in Division 4, they're struggling, but they train and work so hard, and I don't think people realise how much work they're doing. They're training as hard as anybody else, and there was I started a project there, but this opportunity came my way, and I think you have to go for these things in life sometimes, and just go for it. And when the opportunity came up, I said I just couldn't turn it down, because if I said no to it, it could be 4 or 5 years down the line before it becomes available again. And I didn't want to do that. I said I wanted to go for it. And look, the lads in Waterford were very understanding. They were disappointed, obviously. And look, I was disappointed as well. Didn't want to be leaving anybody down. Not my way of doing things. So, but look, as I said, the opportunity came up, so I had to go for it. And I probably would have regretted it if I didn't go for it. And look, it is what it is now. And we're going to drive on. And hopefully, look, I wish Waterford all the very best. There, as I said, they're a very honest bunch, and county board fully support the football team down there. And I left a lot of good memories down there, so hopefully they can drive on as well.
So as a just a sports fan this year, just watching the Ladies Football Championship, I enjoyed it so much. And Meath, obviously, the story, and they did something absolutely phenomenal, and I'm sure they're going to inspire a lot of teams around the country who are maybe struggling a little bit and think that an All-Ireland title might be beyond them. They've shown a blueprint, a template of what needs to be done, what can be done. But for somebody like you now, who's taken over this Cork team, and I'm sure you were probably thinking about it the last little while anyway, what it would be like. What were you thinking when you were watching what Meath were doing this season?
Yeah, look, I came up against Meath with Tipperary in 2019, and Tip beat them in the final. And, you know, I think maybe that actually benefited Meath, because they had another year at intermediate level, like to blood their players, and they were phenomenal this year. And I think they've given every team in the country, that bit of a spark that they can go on and achieve this. Like, in teams who haven't been, maybe getting to All-Ireland semi-finals the last few years. And I think it's going to put more pressure on the likes of Dublin and ourselves, because we were the standard bearers, and now, you know, Meath are up there, and they're up there to be shot at now. But, like, they don't look like they're going to go away. They have a very young profile to that team, and look, I know the lads involved with them. They're serious operators, and their players, they saw something they believed in, and they went for it. And I think, every team in the country now can decide, right, if we have a plan, we stick to it, we buy into it, we do the training, we do the strength and conditioning. We believe in ourselves, I think, and fair to me, they backed themselves 100% this year, and that final was an incredible spectacle. And you kept expecting Dublin to do something to make the breakthrough, but me kept repelling them, and fairness to them, it was fantastic to watch, because, as I said, they suffered a lot of disappointments themselves. They lost two All-Ireland finals in a row, won the third one, which takes great credit to them, those players to keep coming back. But I think it benefited them, those extra years in the intermediate, and they built themselves up, and fair play to them. I think they've certainly opened up the whole championship for everybody for the next couple of years, I think.
And they've also shown as well that Dublin aren't invincible, despite everybody expecting them to nearly, I suppose, cruise to that fifth All-Ireland title in a row. It feels, Shane, that the playing field is quite level now heading into next season.
Yeah, I'm expecting a very open championship next year. There's a lot of teams there who know believe that they could win it. Whereas before, for the last couple of years, like, Dublin have been ahead, maybe Cork slightly behind them, and you had Mayo and Galway, trying to knocking at the door, trying to get there as well. But now, like, Armagh were excellent last season. You have the way Meath did it this year, and there's other teams there as well. Like, Tip will be looking at that they beat Meath in 2019 final, and can they get back up there? And there's loads of good players around this country, and I think the standard is only getting better every year. And I think it's going to be a very exciting championship next year. One that you can call. Look, the Dubs are probably still going to be favourites, because of the caliber of player they had, but it's there to be won, and I think that's going to make it very exciting next year. It's not predictable, and I think that makes it very enjoyable. Like, it's not predictable championship.
Yeah, we got a great final for sure, and it was so enjoyable. Just one of the best games of football I've seen all summer. But earlier in the championship, there was a bit of frustration from the likes of Mick Bone and Maxi Curran, just about some of the issues with the physicality in the game, and maybe the rules aren't fit for purpose. If you could change anything about the game, what would you change, Shane?
I think the rules are there. I think in some days they're implemented very differently, and I suppose the ticking system with the yellow card, I suppose, can be very frustrating. Like, that players are getting ticked for little fouls that aren't really malicious or anything like that. And I think that's the most frustrating thing, the consistency with the ticking, and then you're getting yellow cards. And there was a lot of players in a lot of games this year I saw maybe commit six fouls, get no yellow card, and then in another game they committed three fouls and they got a yellow card. I think that's, and they were all very similar, I think that's the huge discrepancy that's in the game, and I think that's what caused a lot of the frustration for Maxi, and for Mick as well. We do spend a lot of time at training, working on tackling and making sure we're tackling properly. We're not doing tackling drills at training or tackling games where we're fouling players. We really concentrate on, staying within the rules of the game. So it's very frustrating some days then when you're getting ticks for nothing, and then there's very cynical fouls not getting ticks either. So I think that's the big thing. The ticking, the yellow cards and the ticking is the one that, I suppose, has to be cleaned up. But I think there's plenty of scope for physicality in it. Players are, we don't want to make it over physical either, because that can ruin the game as well and make it more defensive and things like that. So, like, I just think the consistency, I suppose, and I know that's the one that always everyone looks for, consistency referees, but consistency in the ticks, I think, is is the bugbear with most managers, I think.
Yeah, well, we're heading into the winter months now, so there'll be plenty of time to discuss all those sorts of things. Shane, look, best of luck. Enjoy it. It is a brilliant honour, and I'm looking forward as well just to seeing what you do with the Cork women's team. They have some brilliant players down there, and they have that tradition, so it should make for adding another very interesting element to the championship.
Thanks very much, Marie.
Thanks, Shane. Bye-bye. Bye.
Game on 2FM with Green Firm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back to Game On. It's time to turn our attention to boxing, and I'm delighted to be joined on the line by Olympian Darren O'Neill. Darren, I didn't think I'd be talking to you again in this guise, back at the elites fighting in the final, going for glory. Well, fair play to you.
Yeah, I suppose I wasn't expecting that myself. It was a real last-minute decision to put the name into the draw, but look, we're there now, and we'll give it a good go Saturday evening and see how it goes.
Well, you're sounding very relaxed about it. Now, you said it was a very last-minute decision, but what was your situation? Like, what were you doing that put this in your head that you thought, okay, I could come back here?
Well, look, I'm always kind of tipping away training. It's just the way I am. I always try to keep fit, and, you know, I think with clubs kind of shut down, so I was doing a lot of running last year, and I was actually going to put my name in at the start of the year for the Nationals, and then they came around this time, and I suppose I'd say it was last minute. I was down home in Kilkenny with my parents, and we went out that evening, and I just decided I wasn't going to drink that evening, and went out for food, and I jokingly said, "Mom, ask me, you're not going to have a drink," and I jokingly said, "No, sure, I'm going to the championship next week." And then the following day, I said to my dad, "Come on, we'll go down to the club and do a little bit," and we did a bit on the pads, which I haven't done in a long, long time, and it went all right. So that kind of popped it into my head then. Jeez, I'm not in bad shape here. So I got back to my own house, and Monday evening then I went out and I did a few sprints just to see what the fitness was like. Came through that okay. I was tired, obviously, but came through okay. And I wasn't in too much pain Tuesday, so I rang my dad that evening and said, "Listen, the deadline for these is tomorrow, so we'll put the name in." So he obviously thought it must have went well Sunday, because he said to me, and, you know, I entered on the premise that I would be seated as a former champion, even though it was 4 years ago, but there was no seating, so I had to fight the first weekend. I thought I would get seating, give me another week to train, but anyway, it worked out in the end that I got the fight under the belt, and it went okay. So, yeah, we're back in another final. It's a bit strange. I mean, think about it during the week. God, I think it's 16 and a half years since it's been my first final, you know. So
that's brilliant, though. Like, it's such it's such a great story, I think, especially when we're coming out the other side of lockdown as well. And, you know, people have been going through different things. And just to have that, just to have something at the very end of it, something that you can do that you really love. And, like, clearly you're still very good at it, Darren, as well. If you're through to a final, just talk me through a little bit, just the rounds.
The rounds, I suppose, look, the first fight I had, obviously, I got a walkover last weekend, thankfully, but the first fight I had was against Kane Tucker, who represented us at the last World Championships. He's a very good young guy, you know, he's 21 and 15 years older than him, but I suppose he is, as I say, a very good technical boxer. And I remember years ago, he was quite a good counter-puncher, so I was expecting him to move a little bit. But he came from me in the first round. I'd say his coaches were saying, "Look, this is an old guy, he hasn't fought in 4 years, have a go at him and he'll blow up." But I was happy to get in good and fast, you know, a good fast start. So I got through that. I picked it up a little bit. I suppose the cobwebs were blown off fairly rapidly in the first round. Second round then I kind of picked it up a little bit. In the third round I kind of knew at that stage I had it, so just trying to mind myself and not to get caught. But unfortunately I did get caught, and it was only a small cut, but and it should be fine. Look, I'm back where I want to be, and I suppose where I was hoping to be when I put the name in. It's a nice position to be in.
So what was the most difficult thing? Like, what did you find was maybe the last thing to come back?
I suppose that's a tough one. Look, it's like any sport. If you're out of it for a long time, your time and your distance, all those small little things go, you know, you're probably getting caught one or two stupid shots that you would have avoided by a half an inch before, you know, kind of way, or a centimetre before. That it's just that little bit of time and distance. But I mean, look, it is what it is. I have to show you the experience that I've built up over the years, and hopefully that will get me through.
Your dad must be delighted.
Yeah, of course. You know, I suppose he obviously realised that I was relatively fit, and you know, the hunger is obviously still there. But yeah, it's lovely, as you say. You know, everyone's been in a horrible position for the last 2 years, and the clubs haven't been able to operate. And you know, I suppose our own club season kind of starts, or the home club kind of starts back this week. So it's kind of nice to have, I suppose, you know, a bit going on there that you know, we're back in the final again, and it's something for the, I suppose, the kids to swear to at home, you know.
We were talking, Ruby and I, yesterday about Roy McIlroy and his interview after the Ryder Cup, and just how different sports stars change emotionally and when, as they get older. Do you find now that you care more, that you care less, that you're more invested? For Ruby, he just said no matter what, he was angry all the time if things didn't go his way. That never changed.
Yeah, well, that's the true athlete. I suppose, you know, I would be somewhat the same. I'm kind of my own toughest critic at times, and you know, I could be harder on myself than anybody else, and I suppose, and in turn you kind of end up being your own opponent. But yeah, I suppose at this kind of stage, and as it was the last minute type thing, you know, I just have to go in it for the fun. But you know, there's only so much fun you can have when someone's trying to take your head off, you know. And once I got into a fight, I'd never get into a ring if I didn't think I was going to win, as simple as that, you know. So to put my name into the championships, there's somewhere in me that thinks I'm good enough to win these, you know. And if I don't win it, you're obviously going to be disappointed and devastated the other side of it. So you know, I think it's a choice that every athlete kind of has, or at least should have, if they want to be successful, you know.
So we know how you're feeling now heading into your big fight. How do you think Anthony Joshua is facing after the weekend, losing to Usyk in what was a really unexpected result for most people anyway?
Yeah, I suppose I was kind of a bit perplexed by that, but during the week I was reading all this nonsense online really about, you know, now to be fair, it's mostly UK supporters. And you can understand it'd be, or you can take their point of view. I mean, they're looking at a world champion, an Olympic champion, all the rest of that, and he's their home guy, and they're going to support him. But I suppose for those of us who would have known boxing and would have known Usyk, I fancied Usyk from the start. I think I posted online as well. But the only thing, I suppose, that stood in Joshua's on his side was his size and his height difference, the weight difference, and punching power. Now, while I don't think Joshua has a one punch knockout, he's quite concussive, and you know, he's stopped the majority of his opponents just through competed, or over and over again hitting them so hard. But Usyk is a fantastic boxer, one of the best you've ever seen. You know, technically he's a mastermind himself, and Vasily Lomachenko came through as best friends. They're both southpaws, both very, very skillful, great in their feet, great movement, and very, very technically apt. So I suppose I wasn't overly surprised. I was a little bit maybe perplexed by whatever Joshua's corner had put in place as a plan. They seemed to have a plan A, which obviously wasn't working, but they didn't seem to have a plan B or a plan C or any other plan for that matter. And I just thought his game plan was wrong from the start. I think as the bigger man, you know, we've seen Usyk, again, while he has quite a lot of stoppages, he doesn't seem to have knockout power, and especially moving up the weight is going to be tougher for him. He had his first fight, the heavyweight, the guy retired, but his second fight went the distance with Chiroza. And, you know, I think we saw in that fight that putting the pressure on him, pushing forward, he was going to move, he was going to use what he's good at, his movement and his skills. But you know, Derek Chiroza was that bit bigger and stronger than him. So Joshua, I thought, should have put the pressure on him and should have tried to do that. Take the first two or three rounds just by being tactically offensive. And he didn't. He kind of stepped off and tried to box him. And you don't try to outbox a boxer, you know, especially someone with his skill. So I thought it was quite comfortable, to be honest with you, throughout the fight for Usyk. There was maybe two rounds that they were, I suppose, very, very close. And with Joshua being the champion, I'd probably just say that the judges might give that to him. But I don't think they did, which was very, very good to see. We've obviously seen some disgraceful decisions over the last few years in amateur and professional. But it was good to see that they didn't give, a dodgy decision in this sense. or in this case, you know, and it's good for boxing to see that. But look, for Joshua, it'll be back to the drawing board. He does need to look at his game plan, what he was meant to do, why was he meant to do it, and how is he going to, I suppose, amend that or fix that for the rematch, because, you know, you can't go and do the same thing again, because Usyk's just going to outbox him. It's as simple as that.
Does he have something in his locker, though, do you think, that he can actually go out and get something in that rematch?
Yeah, I think he does. I think he has the size and the strength to be able to overpower push kind of boost on the ring. You know, he needs to, in his corner, I wouldn't tell him to go and push yourself on Usyk, get your jab out, get a step in on top of him, close the distance and put him under pressure. You're a bigger man. You know, you're a bigger, heavier man. And it was a bit confusing again to see why he went out and lost weight for this. I know he's probably trying to get faster. But again, he needs to be using his strength and his advantages over Usyk, which is his size and his strength. Usyk was going to try to use his advantage, which was going to be his speed and his flexibility and agility, which he did do. So Joshua needs to go back to drawing board and just say, look, I don't have the speed, I don't have the flexibility or the natural boxing talent to beat this guy in a boxing match. So I need to draw him into a fight. I need to impose myself on him, push him back, stand on him, close the distance and get off the heavy shots. The heavy shots will tire him. Now, don't get me wrong, it leaves him a little bit more susceptible to get hit as well. But it will tire Usyk, and it'll impress the judges, because he looked the more aggressive, he looked the more offensive, he looked like he's dictating and controlling the fight.
In terms of bigger picture then, when you think about brand Anthony Joshua, which is up there now as him being one of the best sports stars in the world, and, you know, arguably heading into this, he wasn't even seen as one of the greats currently. He was being touted really as being one of the greats of all time. Now, obviously, that whole narrative around him is going to change. But how much damage has losing at the weekend done to brand Anthony Joshua?
I don't know if it's done a massive negative to his brand. I mean, don't get me wrong, I know it's not going to be positive for him, but at the same time, Joshua's brand has always been, you know, he came up from being in trouble. You see the ads and stuff, getting in trouble, reforming himself, coming into a Olympic champion, a world champion, you know, rags to riches type thing. And one thing about Joshua is he's an approachable guy, he's down to earth, he's not that arrogant kind of, you know, mouthpiece. He doesn't really say an awful lot negative. He doesn't need to. He's a big, welcoming and somewhat clever guy, you know. So it'll just be, I'm not really sure how they're going to frame it going forward, but obviously if he wins, they'll be all raving about being a three-time world champion, you know, as opposed to, oh, you lost. You know, he'd be now three-time world champion as opposed to a win in the back type thing. But I suppose those of us in known boxing know how fantastic Usyk is. You know, and he's only the third cruiserweight to come up and win at heavyweight as well, I think. You know, so he is fantastic, and I think it's a huge task ahead of him if he's going to beat Usyk. And he really does need to stop him. So I don't know how they're going to rebrand it. I think myself was a foolish fight to take, because the money for him was in taking on Tyson Fury. You know, that was going to be a huge money fight. Now, I'm sure he got huge money for this one as well, but that was going to be the blockbuster fight. And, you know, you'd be kind of siding with Fury getting over Deontay Wilder and that line for Brit. But, you know, I don't think we'll ever see it now.
Really? You don't think that they will not be able to make it happen? Okay, I had expected maybe they might be able to make it happen in the big Middle East showpiece that they were planning, but maybe back in the UK?
Potentially. You see, the thing now is, like, if Usyk, or if Joshua doesn't beat Usyk and get that belt back, why would Tyson Fury fight him? Hmm. I personally don't think Joshua would have any hope of beating Fury. So he may potentially do. Fury may potentially do for the money, but realistically, if I'm looking at it, I'm looking at the number one in the world is Tyson Fury by a long shot. Number two is debatable. Then it is between Deontay Wilder and Alexander Usyk. Wilder, obviously, Usyk will destroy him in a boxing match, but Wilder had that just one punch power. He can bowl over anybody. You know, and Usyk is so much smaller than Fury, who's what, 6'9", Usyk is 6'3". There's a huge difference there. So, you know, that would be an interesting fight to see if it would be Fury, Usyk, but I just think the size difference might side for Fury. But as for Joshua, I think he's in a really, really tough position, because if he takes on, or if he doesn't beat Usyk, then Fury might not take him on. And who else does he have? Wilder? Wilder could knock him out with one punch, you know. So it's a real tricky position for him to be in.
Yeah, well, it makes it all very interesting anyway, Darren, and we love that. Best of luck at the weekend. I'm delighted to see you back in the ring, and it would be great to win that at the weekend.
That's great. Thank you very
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Darren.
With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavor.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now, over the last number of years, we have all become more educated on the dangers of heading in football. But Galway United are taking things a step further. They are pioneering new training techniques to limit player exposure to what is termed as a high force header. And I'm delighted to say that Galway head coach Lisa Fallon is with us now to talk us through how they have decided to tackle what is a massive problem in football. Lisa.
Did was, I suppose, when we got the report through, the first thing we really did was just look at, you know, do those numbers from the UK data stack up against the League of Ireland and the First Division, which is where Galway United play. So, and it was interesting when we looked back at our own games and our training footage, you know, to see, and actually once we knew what a high force header actually was, and then to be actually able to count them and see where do they occur in training, and then, you know, to limit the number in training, would it be possible to fall within, or to get within the maximum of 10 per week? And it was interesting, really, because in League of Ireland games, you know, our players who would probably be most susceptible to the higher volume, which is usually defenders, the average is 8 to 12 per game. So to take that down and to, you know, stay within 10 per week, really you're only going to get that type of exposure if you're doing some crossing and finishing, or if you're doing some crossing and defending from crosses, or, you know, when you're doing 11v11 games and set pieces, because that's where they mostly occur. So it was really an opportunity for us to see, okay, could we reduce after a game, could we make sure there was enough recovery time as per the guidelines before we go and practice that stuff in the lead up to our next game. And obviously, because in the First Division we generally only play once a week, Friday to Friday games really does help with that recovery process, and to make sure that you can get that the extra bit of recovery time in, and then to limit the number of those training actions. So rather than practicing it for 10 minutes, you might say, okay, we're going to practice this for 10 balls, so 5 from one side, 5 from the other, and that way you're reducing the potential exposure to certain players and the players that are most at risk. So really, once we analysed it and looked at it and we became a bit more conscious about it, we actually found it wasn't difficult to modify it and implement it within the training schedule. And we've been doing it for, I think it's actually 7 weeks now. And the key thing really is that it doesn't impact on the player's capacity to just perform normally in training and to perform on a match day and to get results. And really from what we found is that it hasn't been difficult to implement it, you know, and that really is the case.
And Lisa, just purely from a practical point of view, so you have players who are conditioned to heading the ball. How do you get them to not do it? Are you pulling them up? Are you just telling them that they can only do it at certain times, or just how?
No, because you condition the session. So say if you're doing smaller sided stuff, so really you're only going to get exposure to high force headers potentially when your grid sizes are wider than, say, 50 to 60 metres wide. That's really the only time. So you're definitely going to get exposure when you're practicing set pieces, and you're definitely going to get exposure if you're practicing, you know, if you're building out from the back, you're not going to get the exposure there, but you'll get it if you're practicing a goal kick routine. So it's about looking at where do the players get that exposure, and then just putting that into the session. And like I say, you make sure like the number 10 is not a target. So we wouldn't go into a session and go, right, we're going to do, each player is going to do 10. You wouldn't. You'd do, okay, mm-hmm. we're going to create a normal game scenario, and players in within that game scenario over a 15-minute piece might get exposed to 3, maybe 2 each. So you're still getting to practice it, but one player isn't taking a repetitive or a, you know, a big load. So so it hasn't, look, being honest with you, it really hasn't. And then after the session, you just record it, and then, you know, it's just about, like I said, keeping an eye on it and making sure that you're not over practicing those things. Like, do you really need to do as many as you might have thought? But the reality was, when we looked at a normal week, no players really were going over that level anyway. But what it did do was it just made us more conscious about it, and where we placed, say, our set piece training or the, you know, any aspects of training that might give them that additional exposure, where we placed it in the week, in and how we manage the volume.